This time, Iceland steal everyone's thunder at Euro 16, Cluffy's Forest Glory 78-80, and how Queen's Park almost won the FA Cup. Hello and welcome to, by far the greatest team, a football podcast where fans attempt to answer the ultimate question of life, the universe and everything. Or in other words, just who is the greatest football team in the world? My name's Graham Dunn, self-appointed arbiter of football greatness, and joining me in the great quest, as ever, it's Jamie Rooney. Hiya, Jamie.
Hello, the other self-appointed arbiter as well.
I think we have the criteria and the respect of the world that who better to be judging who the greatest teams in the world are.
I totally agree. I mean, no one will know this because we've never shared this, but you know, this podcast has been a long time in the making. We've got a lot of research. We've got almost 1,000 teams that we've looked at. So we are picking our teams selectively. We're not just picking random teams out of a hat like they do in cup competitions. We've put some consideration into that.
Also, nothing would perhaps, you know, all our arguments are very solid. There's not like any errors crop up at all. I mean, last week, for example, when you prophesized that that Liverpool, but for the ban on English football supporters at the time from European competitions, the Liverpool would have then been tested in Europe, and that's possibly a benefit. But it's maybe not quite as straightforward as that.
Yeah, I dread to think how many errors I'm making on these things every week. I mean, you kind of, if you go through the pain of listening back, you realise that you're kind of making stuff up almost. But I do like to come with facts. But yeah, that was an absolute. I think I got lost in the moment. I mean, I'm not particularly experienced talking about the greatness of Liverpool, and I think maybe that giddy moment lost my train of thought. But you're right, they absolutely would not have won the European Cup, as it was called, in 87-88, because they would not have been in the European Cup even if England's teams had been allowed to compete, because they weren't the previous champions from the last year. That was Everton had won the championship and would have gone into the European Cup. Liverpool would have gone into what would have been the UEFA Cup at the time. And if we fast forward into the following season, Liverpool, that team we talked about, that great Liverpool team of 87-88, who we did talk about, stylish football with beautiful football players in a very, very sexy great kit. If they would have gone on and they won the league, and if they would have gone on into the Champions League or the European Cup, so easy to make that mistake now, isn't it?
It is.
Calling the Champions League the European Cup, or the European Cup the Champions League. It's such an easy mistake to make. But anyway, I'm digressing. Yes, they would have gone into the European Cup in 88-89, and I stand by my revised statement that they would not have won the European Cup in that season, because they would have been amongst AC Milan. Arrigo Sacchi's AC Milan of 88-89, and I think they would have swept anyone and everyone away, which they did. So, yeah, Liverpool would not have won the European Cup in 87-88, and they would have not have won the European Cup in 88-89, in my very humble and biased opinion.
So the argument still stands. It still stands. I like your logic on that. Certainly the one I have spent a bit of time thinking about was the kind of rash statement I made about whether, in fact, David Speedy is Speedy or wasn't. Because I think I suggested that whilst Ian Rush definitely was in a rush, or definitely quick, David Speedy wasn't necessary. And then I stopped to think about it. I thought, do you know what? I don't think I know how quick David Speedy was. He certainly had he was the little man in the big man little man combination with Kerry Dixon, but I don't think that in itself necessarily means he's quick. And I don't remember him being quick, but it's quite difficult to do a search of the, is David Speedy speedy? What I do know is that David Speedy wasn't in the Rumbelows Cup pre-match 100 meter sprint challenge, which I think John Williams, the he had a great nickname, didn't he? He was the something postman, and I can't remember what it was. He played for Coventry, but he was in fact the fastest player in the league at the time. And I don't remember David Speedy being in that. So I don't know. I still don't know quite where we stand on the nominative determinism there.
Well, I went away and I had a little side project where I went out. I set out my goal to create an 11 from goalkeeper through to attack. 11 players that all were in the bracket of nominative determinism, and I really struggled to find many, to be honest. I had Robbie Fowler on my list, but I couldn't really use Robbie Fowler because he wasn't really a Fowler such. So
he's not renowned for it.
No, but what I did find was a Belgian player who played in the I think the 90s and the 2000s, and he was a defender playing in the Jupiler League, and he was called Mark the Man. And I felt that after that point, I didn't really need to look for anyone else in terms of nominative determinism, because I think I'd hit the jackpot in finding Mark the Man, the Belgian defender.
That really is that is literally what, I suppose maybe he played as a sweeper and he was always spare. That'd be frustrating, isn't it? It's like, if in fact his one job on the team was to be spare and not to mark the man, But it absolutely, does what it says on the tin.
It does, and I kind of played a little game in my head that, Mark the Man didn't come to England to play football, but let's say he did, and he's in an English dressing room, and he's getting, the coach is giving instructions to the team, and he's turning to, the defensive midfielders and the left back and the right back, and he's pointing the finger and he's saying, you've got to mark the man, 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 you there, you need to mark the man. I just imagine Mark the Man just sat there thinking, what the hell have I arrived into? I'm being given all these directives. I'm rubbish at marking.
It is crazy. So I'm sure there's some others out there. So that is definitely going to be one to keep an eye on over these coming weeks as we attempt to, as a side project to finding our core objective. We have a side project of trying to put together that team of nominative determinism. But I guess we should probably get on with our main mission.
What we could do, I was going to suggest, just before we get on to the main mission, maybe we can hand this task over to our listener base, presuming that we have one. Ask them to feed back to us via our social media any players that do fall into the nominative determinism bracket. That would be great to hear from them.
We definitely should. It'd be great to pull that side together. So I think let's get on with today's show. So first up this week, we are going back to 2016, and it's a real... there's quite often people talk about those underdog stories and the little team against the big teams. But Euro 2016, Iceland, that really is a little team, isn't it?
Well, there's 11 players on the pitch. There's 23 in the squad. But in terms of the nation, it's incredible that a nation of 330,000 people, just under, can put together a football team that qualifies for one of the most biggest tournaments in world football, the Euros, 24 teams as it was in 2016. It's almost on a par in terms of the size and scale and quality of a World Cup. It's an incredible achievement, that because if you look at Iceland's record prior to that, you would not see this coming. They hadn't even got close. I think maybe the tournament before, the World Cup before, I think they missed out on a playoff with Croatia. I can't remember exactly, but beyond that, there was no sign that Iceland was ever going to be a team that would qualify for a major finals. And obviously, we know that they went on and they then qualified for the World Cup in 2018 as well. But we're focusing around the 2016 team and the incredible achievement of what they did in making the last 24.
It's, as you say, it's not only extraordinary. I mean, to bring for a team to qualify with 350,000 population there, but also for that team to qualify and then for it to bring 10% of its population to the games to watch the tournament. I mean, it's like a family outing. It's just too brilliant that 10%. I mean, what happened to the country's GDP during then? it's just extraordinary. It is interesting. The story of Iceland is, and I said they were the little guys. I mean, obviously they weren't little on the pitch. They're quite a robust team. The achievement is quite something, and there is, you know, this isn't by accident, is it? I mean, Iceland actually, which is not an obvious place. I mean, there are some clear reasons why you can't easily play football in the country, not least that for half the year there's no daylight.
It's true. And do you know what, it wasn't their qualification for 2016 and the World Cup of 2018, it wasn't a coincidence. It was a long-term planning. So around about the turn of the century, 2000s, the country invested heavily and significantly in infrastructure. They built pitches around the island. I've been to Iceland. I've seen these domes, these indoor football pitches, and effectively they made football accessible to all across the whole of the country. I think by 2018 they had almost 150 pitches on this ice island, effectively, and they made football inclusive as well. So it wasn't just these incredible facilities that they built, these all-weather pitches where they could actually play all year round. Previously, they could only play a few months of the year because, as you rightly pointed out, it was dark and bitterly cold for most of the time. But with these indoor centres and these all-weather pitches, they were able to effectively encourage people to play football, male, female, up to the age of 18, no matter what level. And that's a really key thing as well. It wasn't for the elite. It wasn't for effectively, league teams and their development. They were used for those purposes, but they made football accessible to the whole country, no matter what the level. And aside to this, they invested quite heavily in coaching as well. So in terms of making sure that the coaches that were facilitating and working on the island of Iceland had the right education. So whether they had their level A or level B badges, it was imperative that they had the right level of coaching education before they could actually become a football coach. And the salaries paid well as well. So effectively, it's an attractive job. Not only is it glamorous, you know, teaching youngsters how to play football, it comes with a fairly tidy salary as well.
Having coached some youngsters myself, firstly, the salary would have been nice. Secondly, they probably would have appreciated a FIFA level A or B coach rather than someone more randomly just put the cones out and kick it amongst yourselves. Now that Icelandic team, there was quite an influential figure, I guess, in Lars Lagerbäck, if I'm pronouncing it correctly, the former who was at the helm. A slightly unusual joint managership they had, actually, didn't they, at the time? Because he was joint manager with a dentist.
Heimer Hulgrensson. He was a part-time dentist, yeah. But he was also in tune with his football tactics.
And, in fact, took over from Lagerbäck at the after 2016, I think, didn't he? I think he gave up the dentistry. Or pause the dentistry at the point.
He is, and the profile as well. I mean, even to this day, he's still coaching. I think he's with the Jamaican national team right now. So he's clearly, he does a bit of maybe dental work on the weekends, but generally the day job is trying to organise football teams to qualify for major tournaments. Do you know what's interesting, though, about Lars Lagerbäck? Well-known name. We've seen him at plenty of Euros and World Cups with Sweden down the years. The joint management he had at Iceland with Hågensson wasn't his first. He was also a manager for the Swedish national team. And this is a period around about the 2000s. And I saw his statistics. So as the Sweden joint manager, he had an unbeaten record in a 59-game run of 83%. That's pretty impressive. As a sole coach, 72 games, so a few more games, it's down to 67%. So on its own, doesn't sound that strange. Mm. Worked better with the two of them than the one. However, Iceland is the same. So when he was on his own, he had a 32-game run, a 55% unbeaten ratio. But when he was with Hågensson as joint manager for a 20-game run, it was 62.5%. So again, it's increased. So that very straw poll of statistics suggests that working with somebody got the better about Lars Lagerbäck than working on his own, potentially.
I wonder how they... I suppose it depends how he set up. And it might be that he did all the attacking coaching and he left the defensive side to the other guy and then just sort of forgot to adapt that, you know, in those first couple of games when he was doing it on his own. But boss, what are we going to do on corners? What are we doing when we're defending set pieces? Where do we stand?
Oh, just put out the cones. Just put out the cones.
It is a surreal stat, and it's one of the few. It's unusual to go that way. I mean, you don't see a great deal of that joint managership. Roy Evans, Gerard Houllier springs to mind, and usually it is. It's a sort of polite way of then getting, okay, one of you is going to be phased out, and it's probably not the guy who was there at the start.
It's an unusual setup having co-managers, and I haven't taken the opportunity to look at the statistics for other co-managers, Houllier and Evans, but it would be interesting to see whether the unbeaten record or the win ratio is higher than together than it is when they're apart.
I'm thinking Lagerbäck is going to be the exception to the rule. I mean, this is obviously with Iceland, it is, I guess, it's almost like your classic giant killer story. And as a result, you're almost like your non-league club going in against the league club. And, of course, the story you always get with one of those is commentators obsessing with the jobs of the part-time players or the various bits and pieces. And Iceland, it wasn't quite like that. But you had players who had other careers and went on before and after, of which my favourite is the goalkeeper. I don't know if you're familiar with Hannes Halldórsson, who was keeper in the world in that tournament. So before the Euro 16 in 2012, he'd worked as a filmmaker, and one of the films he had produced was the Icelandic Eurovision Song Contest entry film that went with with their entry there. I don't think the year they won, but. And it is absolutely brilliant. So if you look on Wikipedia, the description for Hannes Halldórsson is an Icelandic filmmaker and former professional footballer. Now, I mean, apart from the fact he's basically had my life, I mean, the dream life, what more would you want to achieve in the world than those two things? The guy has played at Euro 16. He plays at the World Cup 2 years later. By the way, at that World Cup, he saves the penalty from Lionel Messi. Now, and that isn't even what he is most known for. It's unbelievable.
That is quite fascinating. And I mean, it is a dream job, being a filmmaker and a footballer. I mean, they were the two things I failed the most at, the two things I wanted to be the most and the two things I failed at. But maybe there's a theme here, because we talked about, you know, I'm a Hågensson, the coach was a dentist and a football coach. Now we're talking about the goalkeeper being a filmmaker. Maybe the requirement to get into the Icelandic football team is that you have to have a secondary job.
Now, of course, so they actually qualified, you know, quite impressively, actually, out of their group. And then they have this big game with England, massive underdogs for that game. And I think the way they won that is extraordinary, actually, because England go ahead in that game, don't they? It's kind of, you might early expect, yeah, exactly. Having scored early, that should, you would have been expecting, if Iceland were to win that game, to maybe do it against the run of play or holding out. Now, aside from the fact they really, they didn't win. It wasn't remotely against runner play, which is, you know, another story about how poorly. But actually, the way they brought themselves back into that game was a mark of how good they were, in fact.
Yeah, I mean, they were organised. And one of the things that had happened in the group stage is they'd drawn with Portugal, who we know went on and won the whole thing. And they frustrated Cristiano Ronaldo in that game to the point that his comments after the game was quite insultive, really. I mean, he just, you know, a petulant outburst, a rarity for Cristiano Ronaldo, obviously. He referred to the Iceland team as, you know, small-minded mentality. And, you know, they're a country of 330,000 people. They're going to be, it's, you know, in a bizarre way, they're going to think small. And I don't mean that as a slur or as an insult, because of where they're situated in the world. And effectively, the number of people populating the island, and the fact that 10% were behind the team as well in France in 2016, you know, they are going to think small. And I think it's that thinking small that made them great. It's kind of, you know, making the most of the sum of their parts. And they're you know, the Icelandic people generally are fairly calm. They're humble. They could be quite quiet or sometimes quite loud, depending on the environment. But they're generally smart people that make the most of their situation. And I think that's exactly what the football team has done here. And they may have frustrated Cristiano Ronaldo, but they did their job. Their job was to try to not lose to one of the best teams in world football, the team that would go on and win it. And they achieved that. And they remained unbeaten. They drew with Hungary, who topped the group, and they beat Austria before they met England. And when they met England, there was, I do remember that game. And I remember the confidence from an England perspective going into that, which is quite stupid, really, when you're, I mean, nowadays, being an England fan in major tournaments, you've probably got a little right to feel a bit confident. I mean, if you're a 15-year-old kid, you probably only ever known that England is successful-ish at world tournaments to make the last stages. But, you know, before that, it was painful, and it has been painful being an England fan.
I talked about the fans earlier, and I think that's the other great contribution, and it's not directly contribution of the side themselves, but it's all to do with the feel of Iceland and the mood they engendered. Because the fans brought the thunderclap, didn't they, to the crowd, which is a fantastic development. It's quite rare to bring something completely new. Now, how there's a lot of debate as to where the origins of that come from. Some say it's from connected to the film 300, not a film I have ever come across. So I might watch that to see if I can work that out. Others suggest it originated in Motherwell, which was also a curiosity to me. It was not the obvious place, but it's definitely it was definitely embodied at the greatest way, I think, in that tournament. And again, that sort of encapsulates the spirit of the team, I think.
It was fantastic. And, you know, what's fantastic about the games that the Icelandic players played in, at the end, they would always go acknowledge that crowd, and they would join in with this thunderous clap. And it was fascinating, because you're right. Until that point, you know, football noise, chanting, songs had always been of a fairly upbeat, quick tempo, or, you know, something that kind of, you know, resembled a popular song. And here we've got this very slow clap that's a bit eerie, a bit spooky, and it's coordinated perfectly and kind of builds and builds and builds and builds. And, you know, I have no idea where it originated from, but in terms of how the Icelandic team embraced it and how it caught on in the tournament, was fantastic. I mean, it kind of lived into the next major tournament, which is the World Cup in 2018.
The other great thing that this Icelandic team bring, and this is, you know, as we go across the pod, this is always going to be a crucial factor for us as to what makes a great team, is we're talking kit. And kits are sort of fundamentally great for us. Now, there have been many great kits around over the years, but I think Iceland take the credit for choosing to base their 2016 kit on the Escape to Victory kits worn in that film. So it's Escape to Victory, a film I'm sure we will reference again at some point as extremely iconic film. If you haven't seen it, I cannot, and we'll pop a couple of pictures of these in the on the social channels. The kits are essentially the same, right down to the goalkeepers. You have the blue with the white and red stripe down one side, and then the white is the same. I saw a picture. I noticed this when I don't think I even noticed this at the time, but I definitely noticed it when I saw a picture and I was looking up a picture of the keeper, and that's from Escape to Victory. Now that in my book is definitely something that makes them great.
Do you know what? That is fantastic. That really is fantastic, because I've watched Escape to Victory so many times, and shamefully, I love and adore the film. And if it's on a Sunday afternoon on Channel 5, I can't help myself but to make time to watch it again. But I hadn't made that connection. I just thought they were adopting the Croatian approach, where they just basically make their flag their football kit, because it looks like the Icelandic flag as well, if I recall. But maybe I've got that completely wrong, and your reference is definitely better. And I had completely
missed
that.
I'm sure that's what it's based on.
I believe it wholeheartedly, and I feel my life has been enriched just by knowing this. It, absolutely. I've just noted a few extra marks for greatness on that one.
So we should get to the ranking system. If you haven't listened to the pod before, or like us, struggle with the basic concept of our ranking system, we'll go through it one more time. It's very simple. We've got five different categories of greatness, ranging from one of the greats right at the top. I really should write this down. One of the greats right at the top, true greats just below that. We have touch of greatness for those who touch greatness, probably our middle ranking one. Just below that, we go for edge of greatness. And then we have a lovely category called blinkered greatness, which is for teams who maybe weren't that great, but we all love them. And after last week's pod, we're opting for additional bonus one, which is our special pot that we have for not great, but without them, we wouldn't be where we are today. Jamie, Iceland 2016, where do you put them?
A couple of things I haven't mentioned just to share with you before I give you my ranking on them. But the of the 24 teams that went to France, they would have taken 23 players.
Mm.
Every single Icelandic player in the squad played outside Iceland. Every single one played in European leagues that were not Iceland. And to kind of give you some context, only the Republic of Ireland and Northern Ireland were the only other two teams that didn't have a player that represented their leagues. But both of those teams were full with players from England or Scotland. So the English or Scottish League, which is perfectly normal. It's always been the case for teams from Northern Ireland and Republic of Ireland to be the majority be populated by teams in England or Scotland. So the fact that you've got this bunch of players that effectively they've not only got this incredible infrastructure that they've put in place, which they've geared to greatness, they've invested in the coaches, they've opened the doors to Football for All, which has created this golden generation of Icelandic players. They've exported players. So they've effectively shared the beauty of these players with the rest of the world, which is fantastic. Just as a side as well. So I don't know if you looked at the squad, the 23-man squad, and this hasn't struck me until we started doing the research on this team for this pod. Every single Icelandic player, surname or family name as we know it, ends in son. Every single one.
Mm.
And that may seem quite strange, but clearly there must be a reason for that. And the reason is, I don't know if you know this, Graham, is that in Iceland, it's perfectly normal not to have a family name, not to have a surname. So effectively, you just adopt your father's name, if you're male, and have the suffix of son, or your mother's name, or your father's name again, sorry, if you're a daughter, but you have the suffix of daughter, which is dottir, basically. So all the players in Iceland, they just have first names, and they just go, even the president of Iceland, they all go by their first name. They don't use surnames, which I thought was quite a fascinating fact about Icelandic names. But that doesn't really have anything to do with greatness. I just thought I'd chuck it in there before we move on to the next slide.
It's definitely good. I have come across this and again, like you, I'd sort of been pondering. It's odd. Why are they all Somme? It's a very bizarre thing.
It is. It's fascinating. No family name in Iceland, which is great. Anyway, back to the matter at hand. Where do I rank them? So, in two ways I look at this. Firstly, I look at it from a Icelandic perspective. This is a golden generation. This is a team where a tenth of the population has followed them to France to play in their first major football tournament. They've also qualified from their group with the Netherlands and Turkey, and they qualified quite comfortably as well. I mean, they didn't win in their last three games, but they had pretty much qualified by game number seven by winning six and losing one. And to win a group where the Netherlands are in is no small feat. I know the Netherlands have had their problems down the years, but generally you expect the Netherlands to qualify for major tournaments. So they've come from a brilliant qualifying group. They've then come second in their group. They've then quite deservedly beaten England in the round of 16. And then they've met the host, France, where they've been caught a little bit short, bless them, and been smashed 5-0 or 5-1, I think it was. If I look at this from an Icelandic perspective, this is definitely a true great, I would say, because of everything that's happened before it and everything happens when it's really happening. However, if I take my Icelandic lens off, and this is where I become unpopular, I would say they're touch of greatness, and I think that's where I'd rank them in terms of this particular team, because it is a touch of greatness. There's nothing that was before. There's the World Cup in 2018, but there's nothing happening now, and they are falling down the rankings. So maybe they're just going for a blip and they will come back. But I think if I was Icelandic, I definitely would see this as true greats. But in terms of my ranking, I'm going to say touch of greatness.
It's difficult to argue against that. I think if I was, their big scalp was Roy Hodgson's England. And I think looking back on that, that's maybe less of a scalp than it seemed at the time. A harsh man might take them down to edge of greatness, but I love the Icelandic story. I'm happy to stick with you on that. So, Iceland, Euro 16, touch of greatness. So, Notts Forest, well, this is this is a fascinating story. And I'm going to take you back to March 1978. And stay with me on this, because this is a bit torturous and tenuous. Torturous in a sort of more pleasing way, hopefully. March 1978, the first episode of The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy comes out on radio, whatever radio it was, the Radio 4 probably in those days. And there's a big fervor all about that. And it's difficult to believe that now, that a radio program coming out might generate some interest. But this was kind of quite groundbreaking, Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. And of course, within that, is one of the central bits of it is they ask the ultimate question, the question of life, the universe, and everything, to which the computer they built to answer this question, Deep Thought, comes up with the answer 42. And I think 42, but for me, 42, it means something totally different. And 42 is, of course, the number of games that Nottingham Forest, the Cluffy's team, went unbeaten in a row, set a new club record. And they did that, you know, at 1977 to the complete run through to 1978. So whilst Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy is being broadcast, asking that exact quirky question, to which the answer is 42, Nottingham Forest are living the dream. They are achieving that. Now, that can't be coincidence, can it?
Well, I mean, sounds to me like Douglas Adams was creating the outputs of the Football League way before Brian Clough was shaping his Notts Forest team. I think this is clearly some mysterious
the reason I think I'm very attached to this story, and I think one of the reasons is that I began when I first 1977-78 was the first season I kind of became football aware and could see what was kind of going on. And so Notts Forest were the first great team. They not only won the league that year, they embarked on this run. They only lost three games all season, and you know they went unbeaten for the rest of that season. I think the run began in November, so you know more than half a season they go unbeaten. This is extraordinary performance. They then go on, you know, the following season they only lose three games. They almost second in the league. They go and win the League Cup twice, get to the final the following season. They go on and win the European Cup 2 years running. So you know they're this incredible side, and because I've dropped into the world of football in 1977. For me, it's normal. I've not known anything else at all. So it's a bit like a Man City fan who's kind of joined the world now and says, oh, they're quite good, aren't they? And doesn't realise that there's this kind of, you know, the previous 30 years of Man City-ness have been largely being the butt of Stuart Hall jokes, which I'm not sure you can even talk about Stuart Hall anymore anyway. But they were a comedy side, and who suddenly become really good. And Notts Forest, it's not so much that they were a comedy side, but it's that if I had got into football a year earlier, the context for Forest would have been so much more clearer, because actually what I would have seen then was a team that struggled to get promoted out of the second division then, crept in third place. So that suddenly that changes into an underdog story, essentially. This team that's come from absolutely nowhere to have 3 years of unbelievable dominance. Yeah, for me, my entire view of Forest was that they were just like this machine that just won games, and this is perfectly normal.
It's an incredible story. I don't remember 77. I kind of remember the back end of the Forest team, and I can't remember football ever being much about the manager back then as it is today. I mean, now we live in the era of the Guardiolas and the Klopps and Mourinho's recently and the Ferguson, where the manager gets this big profile. But I think from a UK perspective, because there's definitely obviously managers outside the UK, he seemed to be like this big personality. And the whole Forest story is just incredible, really. It's like, you know, small town. He's almost repeating what he did at Derby.
Yeah.
You know, going a little bit better. But it's that Clough and Taylor combination, I think, that is, it just works so well.
And the Peter Taylor thing is really interesting. You kind of, because Clough is so much the name, but I mean, it really was Clough and Taylor. And you can really place his successful periods are all with Peter Taylor. Peter Taylor is clearly kind of the what gives him his mojo in one way or another. And you know, Peter Taylor initially, you know, obviously after the Derby period, he then links up with him at Forest. I think in 76. I think it's just after they finished eighth, and it just seems to have this extraordinary ability to pick players out. You know, the kind of the end of the Forest remained a strong side, and one of the, I think they counted in the Big Six, the ever-changing Big Six, five, seven, whatever it is. But they were, you know, they had their place there, which was built off the back of that success. But, you know, that three-year period of sort of unprecedented success is Clough and Taylor at their best, and their ability in terms of finding players. When I looked at this sort of in more detail, there were so many strange things that just wouldn't happen in football today. You know, they brought in sort of you know, three or four players from the Derby side who had led their success there. So you know John McGovern and Archie Gemmell and John O'Hare. But then you have this weird thing where John McGovern has won. So he's won the title with Derby like 2 or 3 years ago, and then he's playing for Notts Forest in the second division. I mean, how does that happen? Then he turns back up in the first division, and then he wins the European Cup twice. You know, he's there for the entire. I mean, what happened? for there to be a year for him to be in the first division, drop down to the second division. It's like Kevin De Bruyne. I did a couple of years down at Burnley or something. It's a really odd thing.
Yeah, it is. It was a different world. It really was a different world. And it's quite interesting, though, because I kind of mentioned about the managers, because I just casually looked at the Ballon d'Ors for 77 to 80, the four Ballon d'Ors at the time. Now, I mean, I'm not a big fan of individual awards in football. It's a collective game, but the Ballon d'Or does mean so much to so many. And when you think about the Ballon d'Or winners now, it's going to be a player from, well, it's generally going to be Messi or Ronaldo, and that's pretty much what it's been for the last 20 years. But it's normally a Messi or Ronaldo playing in a leading Real Madrid or Barcelona team, or it may, you get the odd year where we've had Luka Modric and playing in a Croatia team that wins Cup final, and also a Real Madrid team that's winning the European Cup. So the European Cup generally features prominently in which player is going to win the Ballon d'Or. So, but for Forest and for English football at the time, and English football was dominating at this period as well. It just wasn't Forest. You know, Liverpool were in the mix winning European Cups. Aston Villa won their European Cup, a team I can't wait to talk about, hopefully some way further down the line. But yeah, I mean, in terms of Forest, their highest ranked player in 77 was Peter Shilton in 20th. In 78, it was Peter Shilton in 10th. In 79, they've won the European Cup. It's Trevor Francis, the £1 million man, in 7th. And in 80, I mean, this is incredible. In 80, when they've won the European Cup again, their highest is Viv Anderson in 16th place, a right back. I mean, I can't relate it to the football world that we have now. It's just, it's literally a different era, but it's how things are so and perceived so differently now.
It is. It's really weird. Another really good example of different, and it taps into one of my favorite things, which is kind of convert players who are converted to different positions. The Paul Warhurst factor. So I didn't realise that, you know, I kind of remembered Kenny Burns was their
Forest. Didn't he? Had that big the thinning hair. It's like almost like a Mickey Mills character.
Absolutely. Well, he was a striker with Birmingham, and they signed him. Played him at the back. And he was Football Writers Player of the Year in the championship winning side. It's just, but this is like you know you can't see a striker. Oh no, we just play at the back. I always enjoy it when that sort of thing happens, but it just doesn't feel possible. And they picked up. They had Peter With initially, who's another. He's a really interesting character because he wins the title with Forest, goes off to Newcastle for a year, doesn't do very much, and then joins Aston Villa and wins the title again. Peter With has played for not journeyman teams, but you know, three teams who for most of our lifetime have just, you know, they might finish in the every 3-4 years they might finish in the top six, just as likely to finish in a relegation scrap. And he's won the title twice for them. It's, you know, that Forest thing is extraordinary that you could have that opportunity.
That is incredible, actually, because I think he had a spell with United as well, Man United in the 80s, and he definitely didn't win the title with them. So, or was it Gary Birtles?
It was Gary. Gary Birtles is definitely
getting my lanky strikers mixed up.
Gary Birtles. They had Tony Woodcock as well. He's another a player who was just in the reserves doing nothing and suddenly converted into like England striker, Arsenal striker, Cologne. Was it Cologne or somewhere in
Germany? Yeah.
Another player who's so you think about the league, and this is an extraordinary fact, it hadn't occurred to me could be the case. So Chris Woods was Peter Shilton's understudy, and he was just coming through. He was like an 18-year-old, and obviously it's a romantic story because you've got this club that's come from nowhere. But they spent money on Peter Shilton. They brought the best keeper in the country, and so you know. There was some money alongside the various other bits, but So which kind of, you know, I think they're somewhere between a Leicester and a Blackburn in terms of that underdog kind of thing. But Chris Woods was the reserve keeper, and Peter Shilton was cup tied for the League Cup. So Chris Woods played, you know, as an 18-year-old, he played all the games in there. They got through to the final itself, and I think it was Liverpool they beat in the final that year. Wins the League Cup with Nottingham Forest, and they are the only games he plays for Notts Forest. So a couple of years later, I think he goes to Norwich and begins his kind of, because you can't, you know, you couldn't replace Shilton, obviously, but it's extraordinary that the only games he would have played were in a League Cup final all the way through the League Cup campaign. I was looking through on his career stats. It says he's never played for Forest. It's because he never played a league game for them.
That is incredible. And he would go on and become understudy for Peter Shilton for England as well.
Yes, absolutely.
Get rid of this guy who was, I mean, I don't know about you, it's a bit like growing up. Peter Shilton just seemed to be the only goalkeeper. And there was a time where there was like Ray Clemens, obviously Chris Woods, and I think you had like Phil Parks and all these kind of...
Corrigan.
And I think Gary Bailey was possibly able to represent England. Yeah. So these English goalkeepers, and I mean, no one touches the England first team for like almost, you know, 10, 15 years, apart from Clements, who gets the odd game. I think he had about 60 odd caps as well. Because Shilton just sticks around till he's about 40, I think. It's Italian 90 when he left.
Just extraordinary. The we mentioned him earlier. The Trevor Francis is and obviously that, you know, again, this is this kind of underdog, yet the first £1 million player, the, you know, a real statement signing. And in the so he joined in the second year. So they basically, the money they'd earned by winning the title, he joined for the 78-79 season, and that's the one they got to the European Cup final, and Trevor Francis gets the winning goal. But that was the, again, because of another weird quirk of things, they had, after signing him, which they only signed him from Birmingham, it's not like they signed him from some cross-border thing, he couldn't play for 3 months in the European Cup. So it's absolutely, it's a real thing. So the first game he could play was in the in European Cup final himself, and comes on and plays, gets the winning goal.
That's incredible. I never knew that. That's interesting.
And yeah, and of course, the European Cup final is against Malmo. So, I mean, it's like Nottingham Forest. But, I mean, the previous year, what was it, Liverpool, Borussia Mönchengladbach, or Liverpool, I can't remember who they beat in the Alan Kennedy one. But but here you go. Nottingham Forest not only won the European Cup, they put out Liverpool in the first round.
Yeah.
Do
you recall that, yeah. I mean, I'm trying to think of a way to kind of bring that into some kind of up-to-date modern context in terms of, I mean, so the Nottingham Forest winning the European Cup, I mean, you could possibly put that in the same context of Leicester City when they won the Premier League and then they went on to the quarterfinals. But then it's just being responsible for the highest transfer. It's a bit like, you know, buying Jack Grealish for 100 million from, not, I suppose it could be like an Aston Villa, I suppose, when you look at it. Birmingham, I don't know. Yeah, it's just, but it just seems bizarre that would happen. And I think it's just how football was in those days. And it was a strange time as well for football as well, because I think there was a bit of, you know, that was the kind of the start of when the whole kind of European problems start with hooligans and kind of going into the 80s, and you kind of like where punk is kind of influencing the game as well in terms of fans are organising themselves. But yeah, it's just an extraordinary time and an extraordinary story. Nottingham Forest being European champions not once, not twice, and they wear the two stars on their shirt to this very day, which I like. I think that's a really nice touch.
And of course, they've ended up, it says a lot. They had, obviously, they'd never won the league before, never won the league since. They'd won the FA Cup before, but
59, I think that was.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's they beat Luton Town. There's Gary Imlock, funny enough, cycling on ITV, in generally the Tour de France. He wrote a book about his dad who played in that Nottingham Forest team, actually, that went all the way to Wembley and won their only FA Cup.
It's bizarre. So you end up in this situation where 80 to 90% of what Nottingham Forest have ever won, and certainly the most important stuff, was all in that. In that 3-year period, it's just extraordinary. And then that, you know, and they sort of quite quickly, relatively quickly, I suppose, broke that side up. You know, not too many of those players ever really. I don't think of other than Peter Whitt, who I've mentioned. Trevor Francis went off and played with all sorts of players, but they. Viv Anderson, I suppose, went to
Arsenal. Yeah.
So he, but you know, it was a real product of its time, you know, and especially the kind of the Martin O'Neill, John McGovern, Archie Gemmell, and John Robertson, and John Robertson seemed to be the most iconic. In my mind, John Robertson scored or crossed all their goals. I know that isn't what actually happened, but in my mind, just all the time. And a guy who, you know, beyond it was sort of underachieving beforehand, and I'm not sure really went on to a huge amount, but you just, for that period, just hits unbelievable heights. So I don't think you get any more iconic than Notts Forest. I think they absolutely sum up what is a great team. And it's undoubtedly a great team, both within the context of Notts Forest, but also, you know, their reach has been extraordinary. And all those clips of Cluffy just add to it. You know, absolute legend. So I think it's time to start thinking about ranking. Notts Forest they are just an extraordinary story. When you think about what they accomplished and where they came from. So, you know, this is a team sat minding its own business in in Division Two back in the day, the Championship today, which wins the league and wins the Division One or the Premier League now in its first outing. It then goes and wins the European Cup, not just once, twice. It sets up a legacy that actually Forest go on to become a team which are brilliant for which are brilliant might be overstepping it, but who remain strong for a period of time. We have the first £1 million man. We have, you know, the most iconic manager of any time. At his prime, at his best. I don't often pull out the big one, but I'm going to say one of the greats.
I can't disagree with you. I do love the idea of this football team. And I'm frustrated that I'm not old enough to remember him, which is a shame, because I think I would have loved him. And, I mean, Brian Clough was a fascinating coach. And, I mean, there's a man totally full of his own ego and confidence, but is able to effectively put his money where his mouth is. And I mean, what he achieved at Nottingham Forest is incredible, as you rightly said. I mean, you didn't even mention, which we talked about previously, the incredible games of unbeaten, the 42 games. And it's every time when we start putting this pod together, I have to say that Nottingham Forest were in my eyes in terms of like, oh, this is one of the teams, you know, this is the reason why we want to do these things that we're doing right now. So, yeah, I mean, I've got nothing much more to add. I feel like I'm just filling time for the sake of it, which is stupid. They are definitely one of the greatest of all time.
So Notts Forest, one of the greats. Everyone knows the Notts Forest story and Brian Clough. People are probably less familiar with the Queen's Park story.
Greens Park, 1883 to 1885. I mean, that's a glorious period for football. It really is a glorious period for football. It's quite a nice segue into it as well, because we touched on it briefly, the FA Cup. And it's famously, it's the one that eluded Brian Clough as a manager. He was never able to win the FA Cup, which kind of links us into Queen's Park, because they too never won the FA Cup. And you're probably thinking, why would a team from Scotland ever win the FA Cup? Anyway, the reason is...
Stranraer have never won the Cup.
Absolutely. I mean, insert any Scottish team. although Gretna played in the FA Cup as well quite recently until they got...
Yes, that's true, actually.
But going back to the beginning of football time, when the FA Cup was formed in 1871, I believe, and the Scottish Cup followed in 1873, up until 1887, teams from Scotland were invited to take part in the English FA Cup. And the only taker for the first X amount of years, I think it was 7 or 8, 9, 10 seasons, was Queen's Park. And then the popularity started growing. And I think in the 85-86 season, there was 5 Scottish teams. In the 86-87 season, there was 7 or 8 Scottish teams that participated, at which point the Scots went, we're having none of this because we're getting all our teams going down to England to compete in the English FA Cup while they're also competing in the Scottish FA Cup. So they barred Scottish teams competing from that point. But in the early days of football, Queen's Park did participate in the FA Cup. And in the very first 2 editions, they got to the semi-final in both times. Well, that's not the team we're talking about now. The team we're talking about is the Queen's Park that actually got to the final in 2 successive seasons, in the 1883-84 final and the 1884-85 final. Well, on both occasions, they lost to Blackburn Rovers. Now, we all know Blackburn Rovers, but did we know that Queen's Park were the runners-up in those tournaments? So, Why are we putting Queen's Park as a effectively a serial loser in the FA Cup? Well, even though they got to the English FA Cup final, and it was proper teams as well. This was the only tournament at the time, just to kind of give us a kind of context. There was no Football League. The Football League wouldn't follow until 1888. So this predates all of these finals that they were making. This was pretty much, this and the Scottish Cup was the only official tournaments that teams were playing. There were some lower level cup competitions.
Essentially the Super League of the 19th century.
Well, I mean, yeah, officially it was the World Championships of football, because Scotland and England really were the only teams playing at that time, as the game was being exported to various parts of the world, and generally before rules were formed. And it's the reason why we have things like Gaelic football in Ireland and American football in the US and Aussie rules in Australia. In fact, Aussie rules had rules before English football had rules for 3 years. So it was the World Championships of the time. And Queen's Park got to 2 finals. They lost them both to Blackburn Rovers, as we mentioned. But yeah, they would have gone through six rounds in order to qualify, you know, first round through to fourth round, a quarterfinal and a semi-final, in order to get to that cup competition. And this would have been a time where, obviously, the automobile didn't exist. So travel was an issue. The only way to really travel was by train. Train had kind of been around for a few decades by that particular point, and that was the only way you can get between games. So it wasn't unusual in the early days of the FA Cup that teams just wouldn't fulfill their ties. And the opponent would get the walkover because the travel expenses were far too much. Even though football was soon to be commercialized, even back then, it really wasn't capitalizing on its popularity. And just to kind of give you an idea of its popularity, the 1883-84 final, which Queen's Park lost to Blackburn Rovers 2-1, I think with some dodgy refereeing as well from what I've read, it was 12,000 in attendance at the Kensington Oval, which was a record at that time. And the Kensington Oval we know today as the Brit Oval, I think, or I don't know who's, whatever.
Yes, yeah.
Whoever the sponsor of the Oval is in South London. That is where football took part in the early days.
That's incredible. And as you say, it hadn't really occurred to me the travel aspect, how much of a restriction that would be. And it's... a fair distance to get down there.
Trains, some people could argue, probably run just about the same these days. But yeah, I mean, they would have been long and costly journeys to transport the players down. The things I picked out, with my semi-limited knowledge of football and understanding it, I think this could have been I've built this idea in my head and constructed my idea. This was a clash of styles between Queen's Park of Scotland and Blackburn Rovers of England, because the English were famed for effectively the development of what is the modern game of football. But they played this kick and rush dribbling game where effectively, you know, your formation was your classic 1-1-8 or your 1-2-7. And the idea was that you would just move the ball forward. Whoever had the ball, they would take it forward until they lost it. And then the next player would take it forward. It was this kind of, you know, strange counter-attacking style whereby the Scots credited with the passing game. So they were the ones that decided, actually, you know, we can move this ball in more directions than just forward. And we can actually move the ball to one of our teammates in order to get round the player rather than trying to dribble around a player. You know, something I've been guilty of many times when I've played in the game.
I like to think there's someone, there would have still been a couple of people watching from the sidelines the first time they attempted this passing. You know, if they're not one up in the first 10 minutes, launch it, dribble.
Maybe this is the first version of Rosette.
Yeah, I
mean, that's the thing, because at the time as well, it kind of predates the Archibald Leach time, I think, where Archibald Leach, effectively, not the actor Cary Grant, the architect who's responsible for quite a lot of the football grounds in England and Scotland. So this idea of terracing wasn't really developed, but what clubs have done, they kind of reclaimed land or just get a loan in order to build these banks so they can accommodate these masses. And I mean, and crowds grew. Football was popularized pretty much from the very beginning, and it's a great leveler. It's a game for everyone. It, you know, formed famously by your public schools, your Wanderers and your Old Etonians, and effectively it was recreated by the everyday working class man. And the Football League, when it developed in 1888, was generally teams around the Midlands and the northwest of the England. But getting back to this game, these two games with Queen's Park, why do I think it's great? I think the whole idea that a Scottish team can compete in the FA Cup, and I think this, you know, there's been the argument, should Celtic and Rangers join the Premier League? You could sit either side of the fence on that. But once upon a time, Scottish teams were welcome. They did take part. And Queen's Park very nearly became the FA Cup holders. And at the same time, they did actually win. In these two finals, they lost to Blackburn Rovers. They did actually win the Scottish version. So they could have effectively captured a unique double, which has been done since.
In 1997,
Cardiff famously won the FA Cup. Cardiff,
yes,
Welsh football team. And at the same time, they won the Welsh version of the FA Cup. I don't think it has the same professionalism as the Scottish one would have had at that particular time. But they did actually claim that unique double, and they're the only team to do that. But Queen's Park could have done that. I think what's interesting to note as well is the influence that Scotland had. Scotland's always had a massive influence with I think, English football. I mean, just look at some of the great managers that we've seen tear up the English Football League: Shankly, Ferguson, Busby, and obviously Jock Stein in Scotland, the first Brit to lead a team to win the European Cup. A lot of the players at the time in Scotland came down to England because England became a bit more professionalised and the wages were better. So players would move down from Scotland. So the Blackburn Rovers team that beat Queen's Park actually had four Scottish players in that side. So their influence in that, and the Preston North End team, the real Invincibles that won the double in 1889-90 season that we may get the chance to talk about at some point. They had the majority of their playing staff were from Scotland. So Scotland has massively influenced the game, and Queen's Park were the forebearers of Scottish football. They would go on and win their 10th Scottish Cup in 1893, their final Scottish Cup that they would win. But they're still ranked third on the all-time tally behind Celtic and Rangers.
Oh, that's...
In over 100 years of football, still no team has been able to win the Scottish Cup more time than Queen's Park, other than Celtic
That's
and Rangers.
That's too good. That is too good. There must be, of course, whilst they're winning, I mean, this is the great thing about sport. When the good times are there, it's difficult to imagine it never being, you know, when Liverpool were winning all their tournaments in the 80s, 90s, it was difficult for them to, you could never really imagine they suddenly go decades without or a decade without winning anything. Or probably something Man United fans are familiar with presently. But at least, but if you're Queen's Park and you've won 10 Scottish Cups, you're not expecting to go 120 plus years without adding to that total, are you? That's quite depressing. It was probably the last, you know, those... The winning captain of the 10th cup as he's walking off his hopefully this is we'll be back again next. Oh no, 120 years, no, that's an unbelievable thing.
It really is, and I can't imagine going that long without winning anything. As much as you referenced being a Man United fan can be a bit painful at the moment. A thing that interests me as well, when I looked at the lineups of these teams, and I mean, there are names in these teams that I don't know if anyone would ever know of any notoriety, and I really am leaning on Wikipedia to help bring flavour to these facts. But one thing that stood out in the Queen's Park team, they actually had a doctor playing for them, Dr. John Smith, who was a... a physician. I think it was quite interesting that you've got a doctor on the pitch, but also a doctor of medicine. So effectively, you know, this is before physios were really a thing, but, you know, if players did go down with any kind of, you know, disabling symptom, he was on the field of play to potentially remedy that. I don't think any of that ever happened.
So was he with Blackburn or with Queen's Park?
Queen's Park, yeah. This is all Queen's Park. Blackburn.
This is screaming to me, ringer, John Smith, Dr. John, John Smith, tell him you're John Smith, playing for the Scottish.
Yeah. I don't think it's the Pocahontas version either, so I think it kind of is a bit later down the line. But he looked like an interesting character because, I mean, I made some notes in terms of what he was. He was also a referee. He also played rugby union. He went on a tour with the British Lions to Australia and New Zealand. He was the first player to actually score a hat-trick in a Scottish Cup final. And he also played for the famous Corinthians team.
Oh, wow.
The Harlem Globetrotters of the day in the football world. And subsequently got banned for playing for him in the Scottish League because it went against the Scottish rules. So maybe he was a bit of a rebel as well. A jack of all trades, really. So
this is good. Again, you know, when you're looking at, you know, traits that don't exist anymore, like being converted, as we're talking about, converted striker, defender. The other one is people who can play, you know, Dennis Compton can play cricket for England and football for Arsenal. So how does this work? How can you be good at... Oh, clearly, if you're good at sport, you're good at sport, but it does feel... John, can we get someone else out to go on the rugby union tour? We'll get John Smith.
It absolutely just goes back to English football culture, though, isn't it? It's like all sporting culture because it was that the winter was football and then the pitches were converted to cricket. And so you could do both and you could continuously play. I remember playing I worked for a company and we had these European football tournaments every summer and they were fantastic. And we'd go to places like Spain and Italy and France and we'd go to some amazing locations. We had one tournament at AC Milan's training centre and the pitches were lush. It was just so well organised. And then the UK hosted a tournament and... We couldn't get a pitch anywhere at the time. It was in the late 90s. So we just had to get these converted football pitches. So you get these European guys turning up and they're used to these conditions we played in. They're wearing their sliders and they're looking at all the things at the part, being a, you know, a professional player with the headphones on. And then they get this council pitch, you know, effectively, that's kind of a cricket circle around. And they put some white lines to map out the football pitch just to allow this football tournament to take place. And it's on a slope. It's just like... It's classic British sporting culture, which has changed.
Yeah.
We'll hasten to add now, it has changed quite some.
I think it's a great story. I mean, clearly, what would get them to greatness was if they'd managed that double, that to have the Scottish English Cup double would be something special. But are they great enough?
I do enjoy this story. I enjoy all our stories, to be honest. But I love the idea of the ancient and the old. And this is football when it was just becoming the modern game that we know. And you've got Queen's Park, who I like to think, and we haven't substantiated it, but they were the pioneers of the passing game. And they were coming down and they were competing in the English FA Cup and they were playing a different style and it was allowing them to navigate through, you know, six or seven rounds of games where they would have to travel incredible distances. When travelling, the United Kingdom wasn't an easy thing to do, to play in these great finals, these new finals in, you know, effectively football grounds that were converted into cricket grounds. They did lose both the finals we talked about to Blackburn Rovers. They did win their own competition in Scotland, but still something great about it. But I don't think the greatness is enough to warrant anything than being on the edge of greatness. And I think Queen's Park is for me, it's one step above Blinkered, because the story is great. So I'm gonna put it in the edge of greatness bracket.
As you say, if they had won the FA Cup, if they had that bit of silverware, I think that is what would lift that team into a level great, you know, undoubted pioneers. I'm very, very much impressed with their ambition for trying to for entering the cup, especially with this travelling distances involved, and you know, for their great originality of bringing in a ringer to with the great John Smith, has to be a ringer. So I don't know, but then, you know, I don't know, but Edge of Greatness or Blinkered Greatness? I don't know. Having said that, they're not quite Blinkered Greatness, are they? I don't think it's a sort of a, it's, I don't think it's a love for them that is blinding us on this. I think Edge of Greatness probably does sum it up. They were so close to achieving something that nobody else could or has yet achieved. So maybe I'm with you on Edge. Yeah,
we're agreeing. I think I'm gonna... really, really well with each other this week, aren't we? I mean, everything is just kind of flowing in the same mindset.
It's a trio. I think it won't be like this every week. It won't be like this every week. But yeah, no, I say Queen's Park, Edge of Greatness. So one thing we like to do at the end of each pod is to bring out our TARDIS, our time machine, and give us the opportunity to go back and watch it. So for this weekend, if we were going to go back to any of those games or any of those teams, Jamie, where are you tempted? Queen's Park, Iceland, or Notts Forest?
I'm really torn on this, actually, and I'm torn between Nottingham Forest, Brian Clough's Nottingham Forest, and Queen's Park. There's something fascinating about seeing football played in the early stages, and Brian Clough had obviously honed a very modern-day style with slick, wonderful play, you know, famously, you know, keeping the ball on the ground and having the passing game. But the same token, Queen's Park may have been introducing the idea of this, keeping the ball on the ground in the passing game, in their cup finals with Blackburn Rovers, and who were probably doing kick and rush. It's a tough one, but I think the historian wannabe in me would go back to the mid-1880s and watch Queen's Park, I think, compete in the English FA Cup. I think that's how I would be spending my time in the time machine this weekend.
I'm loving it. I too am torn between Notts Forest, but I'm torn between Notts Forest and Iceland. And I can't believe neither of us are going back to watch Cluffy's Forest. But just the idea of being there in the crowd, I'm getting ready with my clap my thunderclap is going. I'm there embodying that spirit, and being part of that. I can't imagine a concert where 10% of your country are watching your finest moment, and they're doing it with such fun. I think for me, I have to go back. I have to go to France with Iceland 2016.
That is incredible. Neither of us went for the Nine of Forest.
Yeah, which is a no-brainer. That's the obvious team to go for. Oh, madness. Okay, well, Jamie, thanks for your time this week. That's all we got time for. Please get in touch with any comments, additions, corrections about any of the teams you talked about today, or any suggestions you have for other great teams we should cover. If you've enjoyed the podcast, please leave a review. Don't forget to subscribe to the podcast, and we'll see you again next time.